Welcome to Tom Rhodes Radio. Thank you for listening. If you haven't seen it already, please take a look at TomRhodesRadio.com, my badass brand new website that I had made for this lovable little podcast. Today's episode is a very special episode. It would not have happened without my guest, Margaret Cho. Margaret is someone I have infinite amount of respect for. I met Margaret in the early 1990s when I moved to San Francisco. We kind of developed and got great and hot around the same time. We were both given our own sitcoms on network television about the same time. I've really been inspired by the career choices she's made and how she's turned a lot of painful events in her life into art and comedy. So I've always wanted to have Margaret as a guest on my podcast. We've been communicating. A few weeks ago when I was in Los Angeles, I contacted her and she told me she was going to go to San Francisco for Comedy Day because this year it was dedicated to Robin Williams. So at the last minute, I bought a plane ticket, flew to San Francisco. I'm so glad I did. It was great seeing all these old 1990s San Francisco people from the comedy world. It was kind of like a high school reunion for us. And Margaret is an adored icon of San Francisco. It's great to see her showered with love. I never would have gone there and had this wonderful experience had she not suggested that I go there. We recorded this episode the next day in her hotel room. And, you know, it's like the very first time I ever met Margaret. She's turning me on to cool things, music. Now we're older. We've both traveled the world. She gives great worldwide travel tips. The Korean cinema that we talk about, since we recorded this episode, I have seen the Korean classic Old Boy, and I highly recommend that film. It was a fucking mind-blowing film. So Margaret is so full of wisdom, life, and humor. I love her to death. She is the Joan of Arc samurai warrior of American stand-up comedy. And it is my absolute pleasure to present to you now the one and only Margaret Cho. Margaret Cho, ladies and gentlemen, how was your comedy day?
It was really emotional. You know, I would see people and immediately start crying, which was really weird. But also nice, you know, when you see like Bob Sarlat, you have to start crying because it's so beautiful.
Why, that he's still doing it? Or you remember being a young person?
I was so young. Yeah. Like when I saw Durst, I just started crying. Yeah. I hadn't seen him for like 15 years.
Why was like those guys, like Bob Sarlat and Will Durst? I mean, like at least those were like nice guys. I remember like... I remember when I moved to San Francisco, there was some older guys that were like kind of felt threatened, know, when like young guys were doing good and stuff.
Yeah.
I guess none of those people are around.
Well, also nobody was ever really that threatened by me because I'm like a girl and I was so young and it was a little bit like, well, she's so different. And, you know, I get by skated by a little bit easier.
You blew in a breeze of fresh air that needed to happen because it was like the white straight male perspective had been beaten to death in stand-up comedy.
Yeah, and so there hadn't been that many girls, and there certainly hadn't been that many young girls, and certain no Asian women. So it was I was pretty welcome, and I never felt the bitterness until later, like when I started doing television. And even then, you know, people really kind of got, they were like sort of, they got that I was not going to be around and, you know.
Well, I think also everybody had a crush on you.
Yeah, that's
everybody
too.
Wanted to fuck you.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I think you had that also.
I had that also.
Where you probably didn't have to deal with some of the more prickly dickheads that I did.
Yeah, because you also had quite a few people who want to fuck you, but you don't want them. And also, you know, it's definitely, I don't know, there's certain things where people talk about comedy for women and how hard it is, but really, for me, it was pretty easy. It made it easier being a woman, just because it was something that wasn't seen or heard. And so I got it pretty easy in the beginning, I think.
No, you weren't lazy. You know, you came with new material all the time. You were developing your voice. You know, I mean, I moved out here from Florida and I had already developed a little bit. And I somebody asked me this once in an interview about San Francisco in the 1990s. They said, did you know you were being a part of history when it was happening?
Mm-hmm.
Like, no, we were just good friends trying to impress each other.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's true.
But there was so many brilliant comedians here, you know. Mark Maron, Greg Proops, Patton Oswalt, Blaine Kapach, Dana Gould was here. And the people that on my podcast have heard me say this a bunch of times, but I'll never forget The Guardian ran this thing in like 1993, 1994, the pinnacle of 90s stand-up comedy, mm-hmm. and saying that stand-up comedy was dead. And then they mm-hmm. stopped running listings mm-hmm. of the comedy in the free weekly.
That's so weird.
And it was like, that was the height of American humor.
I think I had gone by then. So I think I was... I think I just left.
It was a friend of yours who wrote it.
And was pissed that I left. But I mean, I don't know why anybody would say that, because comedy was always a major thing here. I mean, it still is.
I think stand-up comedy was invented in San Francisco by Mark Twain when he first started doing his live lectures.
Right. That's exactly right. So it is a birthright. It changed a little bit in L.A., and then it became something very strange, you know, the posse. It became like the posse, you know, like everybody that would go to Dave Rath's house.
Yeah.
You know, all those people. And then, you know, it was just this thing about, you know, kind of, it was very social and an alternative comedy was happening. You and I both did the same thing where we were welcome both in alternative rooms and in comedy clubs because we could play both.
Right.
You know, there was a thing in our acts which allowed us entry in both, and that was very rare because there's only a few people that could do that. A lot of the alternative comedy, they couldn't play comedy clubs.
Right.
You know, because they couldn't fill them and they couldn't do the time. But we could do both really easily. It was pretty ambidextrous. So in that we were really lucky, I think. I can't think, well, that would be like Maron, maybe, you know, like Patton, those people. Like Brian Posehn, he could do both. Greg Barrett could do both. But it was definitely very split. And you had a resentment from club comics towards alternative comedy. And then alternative comedy just didn't even take club comedy seriously.
Right.
You know, it was a weird value judgment on where you came from. But we were able to play both sides, which is good.
Yeah. Now, how did Comedy Day make you feel? Yesterday was like dedicated to Robin Williams.
It was great. I wanted to bring it. I wanted to bring it to Joan Rivers too. That's my the person that I lost. That was really hard. And but it was great to celebrate Robin. You know, Robin was so amazing in that he would give like money to people who needed it. You know, I'm talking to like Mike Dugan and his experience with that. And then like, you know, Lank and Earl were talking about it and how Robin was like kind of the one, he was sort of the big daddy. You go to him for what you needed. He bought paintings from guys that I went out with. Like, it's just totally like a dad. Your dad, you know, for the dad of comedy.
Or you could squeeze him for some money.
Yeah.
Well, because I only met Robin Williams once, and it was always the story where Robin Williams is always popping into the clubs and Comedy Day and all these different things in San Francisco. I only met him about 3 or 4 years ago in Mill Valley after the Throckmorton show. We all went to dinner in Mortsall. He was very interested in me and the life I had in Holland and my wife being from Rotterdam. He's asking her all about Rotterdam. I guess he hung out with all the comedians at the table, so I guess he already knew their story or something. But there was one guy, and I saw him yesterday, a peripheral comedian in the Bay Area. I won't say his name. And he comes up to Robin and he says, hey, man, did you get the email I sent about such and such's benefit? And Robin went, oh, my God, of course. And he reached in his pocket and pulled out all the wad of cash that he had that I would guess was probably about $300.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that really stuck with me. And I thought about it after he killed himself, that what a douche that comedian was to put him on the spot.
Yeah.
In front of a bunch of other comedians.
Right.
and then squeeze him for some cash.
Yeah.
And I thought, fuck, you know, all kinds of people must have came to him with their hands out all the time.
Yeah, yeah, for sure, for sure. It's one of the things that is really unfortunate, but he gave it, you know, for whatever reason he had it. And it's really sad that we weren't able to pay it back. You know, we should have found a way to pay it back. We should have figured out that he was in a deficit, you know, not financially necessarily, but, you
right.
know, in other ways, like, you don't do that to somebody. You don't keep on asking. You don't keep without giving something back. And
right.
I think we just couldn't figure that out.
Well, the strange feeling I had when, after Robin Williams, you know, killed himself was, wow, if he's not happy, mm-hmm. none of us comedians stand a chance.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah. But I don't know if it's like what it is. Depression, I think, is something that is very common to us because
yeah.
we just obsess on things. You know, that's just the nature of the business. That's what we are. We're obsessive, right?
Yeah.
That's it. So how do you get that? How do you get that? But without the bad effects too? The obsession is not like a negative by nature too.
Yeah, and they showed his that work schedule where he had like no days off,
mm-hmm.
and it just seemed like no joy in his life. But I didn't realize until yesterday talking to you that you were so close with Joan Rivers. And I read the blog on your website this morning
mm-hmm.
that you wrote after her funeral.
Yeah.
About, you know, John Waters crying his eyes out.
So sad.
Yeah.
That's the saddest thing if you see John Waters.
Wow.
It crying. You just can't. It's just, I don't know. Everybody was crying though. Because we're not used to the idea of somebody that vibrant going away. She had a long life.
Right. And as a female comedian, I mean, she really, she, you know, she fought a lot of the Joan of Arc battles for women comedians in the Mad Men era of the
yeah.
50s and 60s coming up through the club scene. And then her husband kills himself.
Yeah,
and then she
horrible.
Turned that into material.
Yeah.
The fact that she dealt with all these tragedies and adversities and kept making jokes about it. And then
yeah.
she did have a really harsh, dirty sense of humor.
Yeah.
So to stay in the public eye, and then she pissed a lot of people off. The
yeah.
red carpet stuff and like a lot of, you know, sensitive people in show business are. I'm sure
yeah.
there was a lot of grudges.
There was a lot of grudges and a lot of animosity, but she was a slave to the joke. She didn't care. She just wanted to make people laugh. It was like, it was so admirable. And I think in a lot of ways, she just made me feel safe. I think in this business, we just feel so unsafe and we don't know what's going to happen. And we got to figure out, how am I going to do this? What am I going to do that? And she made me feel safe because she believed in me so much. And that was so powerful and such a big deal. I think that's why I'm grieving. But, you know, I think that our closeness had to do with my relationship with her work. And my obsession with everything she had done and my wanting to get to that level, because I knew exactly how I could take what she was doing and make it my own and go even harder. You know, it was
yeah.
a really good thing. And she really believed in me. And every time I asked her to do something, she would do it. Do like 10 jobs for me, like different TV shows, different things. And, you know, ask her, she'd be there. And it was really an amazing relationship, and so now I'm just kind of a little bit lost, but happy that I have a chance to keep going. And now it's making me go harder, like all the things that have happened to me in the last year just make me want to go harder and do more and be better, which is great.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, you like her have never like rested and got to a point like, okay, I've done my best work. You know, you keep like crushing heads and smashing shit.
Yeah. How could anybody say that they've done their best work?
Doug Stanhope says it to me every time I talk to him.
No, he's done some fine, fantastic, beautiful work. I mean, he's tremendous.
Yeah.
I think he's wonderful.
Yeah, I think he's one of the best.
He's one of the best.
Of all time.
Of all time. And nothing better. Like, it's just like, well, like you, nothing better. It's like the top. You can't get any better. Because when you're listening to the stories, when you're just, and I've heard everything. But yesterday when I was watching you, and my friend Jerry, I'm glad that we were seated on the floor because we just needed to just like collapse and just lie down, and because we were hurting, laughing so hard, you know, that is the best. It's the best is in the moment. It's like you're going to continue to create. When you can make some people do that, you'll never stop making people do that, because that's how it's supposed to be.
Yeah, but that was my favorite day of Comedy Day, because you got the big, whatever, 1,000 people sitting on the grass, but having you sit at the bottom of the stage and roll around in the grass laughing was
dying.
It was beautiful.
We were dying.
Definitely performing for you.
Yeah, we were dying, and then we talked about it like for an hour this morning already. we talk about it. I'll see her tonight. We'll talk about it more. But it's really, you know, when you can make people laugh with that humanity and truth, and just about the idea of being. And all the things that entails, it's just really, it's magical. So I don't know, you can never say, oh, I've done my best work in it. There's always got to be more, you know, because there's so much more there.
Yeah, but I mean, that was kind of like the purity of the 90s. I mean, if I could use such a word as purity, but, you know, just making your other friend comedians that you respect and admire laugh, and
yeah,
like, and seeing them laugh, you go, yeah, that fucked, okay, that worked, that joke is quality.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
I made my friend laugh.
Yeah, and that's the most important thing. And then if you can extend that and realize the audience, they're all your friends, they're all people, we are all the same, and that's great. So that's really, really cool.
But, you know, you have such a difference, like, and we walked to that restaurant after Comedy Day in Golden Gate Park, and, you know, people are stopping, you know, it took you a while to get out of there because everybody wants their picture taken with Margaret Cho, and then people stopping you on the street, Margaret, I love you, and I love you because my mom is her favorite comedian.
Nice.
And people wanting to take photos with you, like, you've transcended beyond, like, I mean, like, as loved as Robin Williams is, I mean, now you have the top mantle of San Francisco person, but you represent so many comedians, so many people, like not just the female comedian, but like Asian comedians, and then like the gay and lesbian community,
mm-hmm,
and just you mean so much to people, you know. Like,
oh, thank you. That's nice to say. I feel that. I think it's really beautiful, and you know, it. But it was really nice to be there together with everyone, you know, and I remember what it was like to be. I think a part of this thing, you know, and how big it was. When was the last Comedy Day that you went to?
It's at least 12, 15 years, probably.
So,
a long time.
Like 97, 98?
Probably around there, yeah.
I think it was probably mine, too. It's been a long time.
Yeah.
And
really, you never came back for any?
No, I just never had the time free. And the last 7 years, every summer I'd be working. Deb had been asking me, and then finally it just... you know, it's Robin dying, and I was like, let's all go. Let's just go, because we're not going to make the space another year. This is like the one time that we are all feeling it.
This was our high school reunion for San Francisco's 90s comedy.
It really was. I mean, it really was like this incredible reunion, and it's funny when you see people age, but you totally recognize them.
Yeah.
We see them through the years, and you're like, oh my God, it's so... It's really delicious and funny to see their kids. I love seeing Marty Mercedes' beautiful boy. Like all these kids that were like Trey Force.
She got Piper, a daughter.
Beautiful Piper. She's a beautiful daughter. And it's so cute. So, I mean, I think it was really healing. The Comedy Day was really, it was really healing, really fun, really filled with laughter. It was way, way more for the comics than for the audience or anything. I mean, then that day really is always for us anyway.
I mean, and you are such a San Francisco person, you know, born here and you grew up, your parents had a bookstore. You know, when I moved here, you turned me on to some really cool stuff like Green Apple Books.
Oh, yeah.
You told me about a few like really cool San Francisco bookstores and record stores that I didn't know about when I moved here and I was looking for that kind of stuff. But I mean, come on, that's... How storybook is that to like grow up in San Francisco and your parents own a bookstore? I mean, that's like if you saw a sitcom, you go, no, that's too perfect of a life. That's
it's nobody... pretty perfect.
Yeah.
It is perfect.
And it
was
growing
great.
Up with the influence of the open-minded San Francisco world.
Yeah, it was cool. But then we also had AIDS and everybody died. So actually what you were saying, like that actually happened in San Francisco. There was a plague and it did wipe out half the population. And that was AIDS. It killed a lot of people. And so my family's business went under because all of our business was kind of catered to the gay community. And that totally collapsed because everybody died. And it was so depressing. So there was a lot of stuff that was really dark as well. Jonestown. My family had like...
Oh yeah, that church was here.
That was here.
Wow.
The week after the Jonestown massacre happened, it's like 900, more than 900 people died. Which is the Jim Jones church where, you know, they drank a Kool-Aid. But the original church was in San Francisco.
Right next to the Fillmore auditorium.
And my family, when they found out about the massacre, they realized that building would be vacant. So my mother rented it for my grandparents' 50th wedding anniversary. When she saw all the dead people on TV, she had an idea.
I
know the perfect place. So she rented the People's Temple, and they had the party there. And it was not the best idea, but that's the kind of people.
It was really cheap.
That's my family. It's almost free. So we had the party at the People's Temple. It was really, really fucked up.
Wow. Well, how do you feel being such an icon in San Francisco and all, you know, female comedians? I mean, you are the Joan Rivers to a lot of different subcultures of the human comedy world.
I think that's really nice. I mean, I don't know. Like, I think you just don't think about it that way. You just kind of go on, you keep going. I love it. I love comedy. I love our job. And, you know, I love traveling and seeing everything and seeing the world just like you do, you know. And that's amazing that we get to do that on top of it. Like, we don't just do the United States. We don't just do Canada. We go globally. And that's really an amazing feat for a comedian.
Yeah, and then have friends and comedian friends, like, all over the world.
Right.
I love that. And then when you go to people's cities, they want to show you the best, coolest things, you know, the Green Apple Books of Copenhagen or whatever.
You get very
cool
close.
In that town.
Copenhagen, I like Noma.
Noma?
Noma is the best restaurant in the world. And it's in Copenhagen. And it's, everything is sourced there and everything is foraged and they're very bizarre people. They're like really, really cool. So there's things everywhere, but you get very close to people. Like I love Hannah Gadsby.
Yeah, I love Hannah.
She's one of my closest friends. I almost never see her and we barely talk, but I just love her. You know, she's really brilliant. And whenever we're in the same city, we just walk around and we go to museums.
Yeah.
We just dork out.
I was in I did Tumler in Amsterdam with her the week before Edinburgh this year. So we got to share this massive, beautiful house in Amsterdam South, which is the swanky area of Amsterdam. And she's working on her Edinburgh show, which involved art and stuff. And so it was really cool, you know, to not only share a place with her for a week, but to see her developing, you know, what was going to be her Edinburgh show.
She's like the new Sister Wendy.
Yeah, she really is.
She really is the new Sister Wendy. And I'm like, I think that's what's going to happen. I think that she's going to make that path. But she's really got amazing comedy about body image. And, you know, that kind of stuff really resonates with me.
Yeah.
And then she, you know, is a fan of mine. And so it's a cool connection that we have. But it's one of those things, like, wherever you go all over the world, you're able to connect and reconnect with these people that we love, you know?
Right.
It's awesome.
Right. I met her 3 years ago at the Perth International Comedy Festival. And then I saw her again in Amsterdam. Mm-hmm. And so we really bonded. So then, like, the whole month in Edinburgh, you know, we were friends.
It's great. Perth is a trip. Perth. Good. So far.
I love it there.
So far. It's so far. And then the people are so rich. It's really, really, really far.
Yeah.
They're great. It's like that out. It's that out. It's almost, it's like out, far out. But I don't know. It's hard to explain it. But I've only been there once.
I've only been there once. I thought it was absolute heaven. Mm-hmm. I went the way Muslims have to go to Mecca once in their life. I had to go to Fremantle and put flowers on Bon Scott's grave. That was my Hajj. Oh. That was my... so I got to do that.
That's beautiful.
And Perth is a heavenly little gem.
Yeah.
What are the furthest strangest, most lovable, bizarre places in the world you've performed?
Well, I like all of Australia. I mean, I think it's great to go out there. I really love Australian movies. You know, I love, all, you know, despite Mel Gibson, I think all the Mad Max movies, you know, they're so
those.
Fucking cool.
Yeah.
And then I love...
I am the humongous. do you remember that comedy, Muriel's Wedding?
Yeah, I love that movie.
I loved that film.
I love that movie a lot. And of course, Priscilla.
Yeah.
And I love, you know, I love just... that frontier, it is a really wild frontier. It still is. You know, it's the Wild West in many ways, like Brisbane and Adelaide and those kinds of places. You really get the sense. And even the building, the architecture, the way that all those houses have the kind of weird ranch sort of thing. So you're
Yeah, the worker cottages with they're on stilts with the porches.
Yeah.
On the, and it's really hilly. I love it there.
It's really cool. And then you have a sense that you can feel like the land kind of just being broken. You know, people starting to live on this very, very hostile environment. But it's really amazing. I mean, I love it. I love going out there and doing comedy. I didn't go to Australia. I don't think I'll go this year. I was there for quite a long time last year. I did all of those places, all the little festivals that there, like Sydney and Melbourne and everything. And it was really, really cool. But I don't think I'll go. I think I'll skip a year. And I want to go to Edinburgh next year, I think. I'd like to go back.
Wow, I loved it.
The month is hard, though.
Month is hard. That's a long month.
And then you're fucking one day off, the 11th or the 13th or whatever you get is the best day.
Yeah.
It's like the best day. But you, Bob, would probably have a great time in Edinburgh. You know, if you have a show at like 9:15, that's like, you're at the Gilded
Perfect
Balloon.
Perfect time, yeah.
That's the show that people get the tickets for first, and then they plan the whole, everything else around it, you know, which is really, that's what you want to get, is that perfect time.
Well, and then like you were saying, you know, it's only like at festivals that I get to hang out with, like, you know, people like you or Hannah Gadsby, like other, you know, people you would consider peers because, you know, we're all headliners in our own right. And that, you know, it's usually only festival or TV things that like we get to hang out at.
Right. It's very rare when we get to hang out, especially at this age, too. I think like younger comics or at this level. You know, younger comics, we all sort of rose up together and we all did shows together. But then after a certain point, it becomes very solitary, you know, and then it's just you traveling. And then, you know, it's you don't see people. You don't know what they're doing. And so festivals is where it happens.
Yeah. Well, that was great about Edinburgh, getting to hang out with so many good friends for a month. And then seeing multiple shows every day, like one-person performances and... plays and musicals and just it's inspiring, especially you see someone in a little tiny room that seats 22 people at 2 p.m. just like giving the performance of their life.
Yeah.
And like, how can you not be inspired by that?
Did Rich Hall have his band?
No, he wasn't there this year.
Sometimes he does he does his late night show and I'll go and I'll sing. And it's very, it's really weird because everybody in the band is British except for Rich. But they all act like they're from like Georgia or Central Florida.
Yeah.
They all try to, they like wear like acid wash and they try to act like they have American accents. And it's so funny because they just want to be like white trash so bad. But it doesn't work because they're from Devon. You know, it's like they're all, you know, from Sheffield or whatever, but it's really, it's a cute thing that they're trying to do. And Camille O'Sullivan, I love. Did you ever see her?
No.
She's an Edinburgh person. I don't know if she did it this last year, but she's a singer and she's pretty tremendous, but she has the same range as Nick Cave and David Bowie. So she's a real chanteuse and she's half Irish and half French and she's just gorgeous. But she's got, the great cabaret really happens in Edinburgh. That's one of the things that I love.
Yeah. Well, I waited for years to do Edinburgh. Now that I've done it, I'm like, wow, I can't believe I waited so long. But I'm inspired to write a new hour as soon as I can.
Yeah.
So I can go back. But like a quality hour. I don't want to go with any watery bullshit.
Never would.
But I mean, how often, what about your process for coming up with a new hour? Like, you know, one thing we have to talk about, but I want to know about your, you know, what is it? Like, what do you think about every 2-3 years? What's your cycle for a new hour?
I think that's about right. I think that sometimes it's hard to tell. I try to do other stuff. Like, I try to mix it up. They'll put a little music in there, do a little bit of different things, and I try to kind of play with the audience a little more. In a sense, it's like there are certain things that you want to get across, but I don't know. I'm not sure ever. I think that it's actually very, very easy to create the different shows, but then you get attached to material. You know, we get attached to things and then we want to do them, and it doesn't feel like a performance unless we've done them.
Right.
So that's a little bit, sometimes I struggle with that, but we have the ability to do a lot more than we actually do. But there's certain things that we get this idea we're attached to that what I'm trying to break that.
Well, and often people will like weave a theme throughout there. That's the big Edinburgh thing. And
mm-hmm. That's the thing is those guys, what they do sometimes is they do themed shows that are more like one person shows than actual like comedy shows where it's not like jokes honed over a long period of time. They just think of a theme and then they write a bunch of jokes around it. And to me, that's really hard. But then that's the British way. That's what all those guys do. Did you see Paul Foote?
No.
He's fucking funny. He is really odd and great and a sweetheart and a really beautiful, beautiful guy. He was there this year with his new show. And so there's a lot of really unusual comics. But I love going.
You know, the thing we have to talk about, and I think it's, you know, I mean, you know, I've known you, you know, we're coming up in the 90s in San Francisco, and then you and I both had, you know, we'd gotten hot and given our own sitcoms.
Mm-hmm.
And you, after your sitcom finished, you turned that into a brilliant hour, one-person performance. I'm the one that I want.
Yes.
And my reaction to my sitcom finishing was to move to New York City and get deeply involved in drugs and alcohol.
Oh, I was doing that too. I was deeply involved in drugs and alcohol, but then I had to get sober.
And I saw you bring that show to New York. And,
yeah.
I was so impressed with what you did about it and just the, you know, how the, you know, you felt so conscious about your weight and then conforming to this. I mean, it's, people don't get given the sitcom deals as often as they used to, but still it's to be given your own show is quite a clusterfuck. And then, you know, you start feeling self-conscious on so many different levels of,
right, because what happens is people really don't understand how to write for you. Like, that's what happened with me is they didn't know how to write for me. And then they were just writing for everybody around me and not for me.
Yeah, that's what happened on my show as well.
Yeah, so that was the unfortunate thing. And that, you know, and that's actually a tricky thing. And nobody really gets good at, I mean, even in Seinfeld, one of the most successful sitcoms, they didn't really know how to write for Jerry Seinfeld. They knew how to write for the other characters. But Jerry had to kind of struggle on his own for a while. It took a while for them to get him. And so it's not an easy task. And I was so young, I couldn't really push them. You know, I didn't have the strength of Roseanne. Roseanne was then our age now. So she knew what it meant. And she knew how hard it was to get where she was. And that's why she put everything into making sure that they were writing for her. And making sure she was being taken care of. She was really on top of that. That's why there were so many rumors about that show having so much difficulty, because she was standing up for herself all the time.
Well, and then, you know, I hear stories like that. You grow up, you know, because I love entertainment, love comedy. And then I always thought that comedians who had sitcoms, when you read about them having a temper tantrum and kicking over the water cooler, I always thought, you know, they were kind of like, you know, stupid for doing that.
Mm-hmm.
But now after I went through my experience, I was too nice.
Yeah.
I wish I would have kicked over some water coolers.
I wish I had, but I was too scared.
Yeah.
I didn't know how to. I mean, I was so grateful to have a paycheck and have a job. And, you know, that was more important to me than anything. And I just wanted to keep it going because it made me feel safe. That was like, and most of the things, like you always like struggle for a place of safety in comedy, which is really, there's none, but you want that, some security. And that's what I wanted.
Yeah, I mean, you know, mine was on NBC and I grew up loving NBC. I thought that was, you know, Carson, The Tonight Show, SNL. I mean, mm-hmm. Who am I to throw a little hissy fit.
And it was great. And you got a great deal. You know, you got a lot of money. I did too. And that, I still have it, you know, which is awesome. But it's very, it's very sad because I feel like that opportunity, it was really something I wish I could have again. I mean, I could, but television is different now. It's totally, it's wide open. It's a new frontier, just like Australia in that way. So there's got to be a way to break in. We'll see. I want to get into different kinds of working. I'd like to be a producer. I'd like to do some of that and some writing and writing scripts. And I am, you know, in the DGA and I have written a bunch of scripts, but it's never really gotten to a point of like whether this would be a good thing. But I feel like I'm at the age where that would be something like I would like to take on.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
Well, in just the last point about that whole sitcom period, you know, people don't, you have no idea when you get thrust on that level of fame. And the thing I learned from it was, it's not how fame affects you. It's how it affects everyone around you.
Right.
And I guess that's like the Robin Williams thing of people, hey, Robin, you know, somebody's having a benefit or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But the, like, bad reviews or criticism, I loved Entertainment Weekly from its inception.
Yeah.
And I had a subscription
when
I had my sitcom. And it comes in my mailbox, and I'm flipping through it, and they had this when I had the sitcom. They had a hair chart, 1 through 5, little cutouts of the celebrities' heads. Best hair on television, 1, David Duchovny, X-Files, little cutout of his head. 5, worst hair on television, Tom Rhodes.
That really sucks. You're nice hair.
But like you, I mean, Jesus, you had more of a microscope on you because like you're representing women comedians. Now you're representing Asians. I mean, like I always think, you know, like when black American comedians, it's always unfair that it's like you're not just a comedian. You're representing like your race.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe only America has that kind of view of certain things.
Yeah, it was weird. I mean, that there was a lot of that. There was a lot of like difficulty with the Asian American community and with the community, like with the Korean community. But then now it actually is the opposite because then a lot of Asian kids have grown up with me as the first Asian person they saw on TV, so that there's an incredible attachment to me and what I do. So that audience is really solid and great. And it's meaningful for me, so I'm really proud of that, too. So it's a struggle on one hand, but then on the other hand, I have a lot of gratitude.
Then what was the special you did where you had the iconic Che Guevara?
Oh, that was Revolution.
Yeah.
The Che show. That was a good one.
That was great.
It was good. It was fun. That show did well, too. It was good. It was good. It's you know.
Do you feel like, so you never feel like pressure of like, oh shit, I've got the whole gay community, I've got the whole Korean.
No, because that's who I am too, you know, I'm queer, I'm Korean, and I'm on top of that, you know, like those are my identities. In a sense, those identities create a lot of power and strength within me because it's something that, you know, I've kind of gone through a lot of small civil rights movements for that. So I don't know. I'm grateful for that.
Well, and the thing I like about your humor is, you know, you've always been able to talk about social issues or world events without being like kind of preachy or annoying.
Because you don't want to get preachy. That's like the worst thing. You know, you don't want to get then you're being superior about it. You know, comics, we need to kind of come up from under the joke. I mean, there's things that you can make a point about, but really it's kind of boring to be just preaching, I think.
What joke have you written that you're the most proud of?
My favorite joke right now, which everybody hates this joke, but I said, I think that HPV is way, I think everybody has it.
Apparently everybody does.
I think everybody has it, so I don't, you know, my pussy is riddled with it. I mean, I don't know. The whole point about it is like that, because people ask me, well, what do you think about young girls getting the HPV vaccine? And I'm like, I don't know. I'm riddled with it. My pussy is riddled with it. That's how they make the vaccine. they milk my pussy like a cobra. And it's just so I can make that physical thing to make teeth. And then they inoculate young girls with it. That's my joke. It's so gross. That's my favorite joke.
That's great.
It's only so that I can make the cobra teeth. That's all.
How much pussy are you getting, and what do you love the most about pussy?
It's complicated because I'm not getting as much pussy these days. I need to figure out. I'm so much older now, and now my drive for all of that has disappeared, and so I don't know what I'm supposed to get energy from anymore, and I'm not sure how to maneuver that. That's why yesterday I didn't go out with you guys. I stayed, and then I made some phone calls, and I thought I should get on this, and then I fell asleep, which is actually even better because I'm not asleep. I don't fall asleep like right. that, so I haven't slept for several days. So that was it was actually better. But I need to try to, get back on that, When it goes away in you, it's really freaky. When sex drive
starts to... The desire for the hunt.
It goes away, and it's really freaky. Mm. I don't know who I am anymore, and I don't know what that means. So it's really weird. And I might go, I'm thinking about, hormone therapy, hormone replacement therapy for that. It's also something that I still have I could still get it. I could still get it back, but I have to really focus on it. Because 45 is very, very weird thing. And my family, we all have menopause very early. Most of my family had it, in their 30s. And then had hysterectomies. So nobody can tell me what to do with it because they don't have them anymore.
Right.
So it's very weird.
How much does that affect your happiness now?
It doesn't. I just, now I sort of focus on different things. I think menopause for some people is a great freedom because that you sort of stop worrying about things that had to do with anything like romantic or whatever, and relationships become deeper. It's not all about fucking. It's very strange. It's very strange, but I'm just learning how that's going to go. So I don't know.
The mention of pussy reminded me of the thing about your blog about the Joan Rivers funeral was the line Howard Stern said about, and it seemed like the way you described it, he said that Joan Rivers
he was crying.
Had a pussy, yeah. Dry pussy.
Yeah.
And everyone is silent going, what?
Yeah. But he kept telling the joke. He was telling the joke, and it's just a temple, thousands of people, it's silent. And he's like, Joan had such a dry pussy. Her pussy was so dry that it was like a sponge. And when she would take a bath, all the water would get absorbed up in there. Whoosh. And Joan used to say that if Whitney Houston had as dry a pussy as Joan, she would still be alive today. And it's the kind of joke that every word he says, you go, no, don't say it. No, don't say it. No, don't say it. But he kept saying every joke, he would pause every word. It was a pause stop there, stop there, stop there. And he didn't stop. And I love him for that. I love him. He's a great guy.
What's the best laugh you had with Joan being friends with her, or the best advice you got from her?
I think the best gift that she gave was gratitude, because she was always filled with gratitude. And every time, we'd talk, she would always really drill that into you. You gotta be so happy. You're so lucky. You're so lucky that you're funny. That's all that matters. You always work. You will always, always, always work. Always. You always will. Don't worry about anything. You'll be rich. You'll be happy. And, that was what she drilled into the women comics she loved, is to remember how great it is that we had this gift. And I think the biggest laughs were that she never, ever stopped acting like I was going to eat her dogs. She never, every time I would come over and the Yorkie would be on her lap and she would just hold it really close.
The joke never got old.
It never got old. And she never stopped. Because it was just It was a constant thing. And then she's like, whenever you come over, the Yorkies are so quiet. And it never ended. Always with that. And it was so funny and so stupid. So that was great, is the running jokes, the dumb running jokes. And just, you know, what a spectacular person and what a great person to learn gratitude from. That's the ultimate. I mean, if we can have gratitude, then everything is great. So that's what I had to try to learn from her.
What is the best advice you've ever been given as a comedian?
It was Mike Gandolfi. Open with your silver, close with your gold. But it's really true. It really is true. Yeah. You know, you want to like open really like almost like you're closing and then close like you fucking close.
Yeah.
You know, that's the whole thing, is that you take them up really high and then you just don't let them down. And then you just blow it out. Like, you gotta give it your all. I think you and I both are very energetic performers. We have to do that. I'm not laid back.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, I couldn't stand comedians that would stand there and leave the mic in the stand.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Just standing there and tell, ugh.
Sometimes, well,
tell them the joke, show them the joke.
I know, you got to show them. You got to do it with your hands. Or sometimes I'll take the mic and then I'll do it like a, like flute style. That's my favorite, is to take the mic stand and then put it around so that I can have both arms and do whatever. But yeah, it's not static. It's so, you have to go get them, you know, which I think is appreciated. It's an important thing, but I'm not going to let my ideas just float over you. I need more than that. You know, I need to be physically engaged.
I've gone to Korea twice in the last mm-hmm. 3 years.
Mm-hmm. And you brought my mother a lovely gift. Thank you.
A lovely gift.
Thank you.
I was thrilled to find out your family are from Busan.
Yes.
Because that's my favorite place in Korea.
It's awesome.
It's kind of like Sydney. It's a beach town.
Mm-hmm.
It's just wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not as cosmopolitan as Seoul, but it's cooler. I guess it's kind of the San Francisco of Korea, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, it's very cool. Korea's... it's so interesting now, and I really want to go. I want to go with you and do comedy there. It's something that I haven't been able to figure out what my presence there will look like. It's a place that I've been preparing for. I'd like to go there. I'd like to make movies there. I'd like to make TV there. I'm learning the language. It's very hard. It's very hard to do comedy in another language.
But now I kind of get the impression, because you know, I was writing you and telling you how great Korea was, it kind of, I got the feeling that you don't want to perform there until you can perform in Korean.
Yeah, I want to be able to do at least half of it in Korean, if I can. I want to have, you know, do the American, you know, for like the expatriates and have like an English show, which I think would be great. But I'd like to do like Korean talk shows.
Yeah.
You know, like all the press stuff that they have there. They have like really weird talk shows where people get real emotional. And they kind of bare all, and it's very almost like a game show, but it's not really. I don't think there's enough. It doesn't sound fun.
Anything I would want to do.
But it's kind of cool. Like people get into like a sauna, and then they just do like a sweat, and then they just talk like about suicide and
dark things. Do you have your big bloodletting story that you're waiting for?
I don't know. I mean, I have so many. You know, I have so many of those, and to talk about it in Korean is my goal, to be like emotionally able to express it there. You know, there is a sense that American-born Koreans have a lot of animosity. There's animosity towards us.
And especially if they don't speak Korean. Yeah.
So we need to be able to speak Korean. So.
Yeah, but I would rather see Eddie Izzard that I love instead of... I'd love to see Eddie Izzard in Paris, but mm-hmm. I would rather see the Eddie Izzard I love than Eddie Izzard working his way through some phonetically memorized French.
Right, right.
You know, I would rather see Margaret Cho bring the thunder that she brings.
Yeah, I think I could do both, though. I think I could do it in Korean once I get... Because I grew up with it. I have a background in the language, and I can understand it. The reason I can't speak Korean is because my father was deported, and when he was deported, when I was a little girl, we were not allowed to speak Korean anymore. And so we had it in our head, but we were not allowed to speak it. We could hear, and they would speak Korean to us, but we couldn't answer in Korean. We had to answer in English. It was so much trouble that was gone through because nobody wanted me to speak with an accent.
Right, right.
I was not supposed to be a foreigner.
Right.
And so there's a lot of cultural baggage on there. I do speak the language better than I let on, and it's unlocking those keys. I speak it like a child because that's the person that stopped speaking it.
That's interesting. My mother is from Argentina,
mm-hmm.
and she came to America in the 50s, didn't speak a word of English. And she married my dad when she was 18, and it was not cool to be a foreigner in the United States in the 50s.
Right.
So I was not taught Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, it's my ultimate shame. I've been to Argentina a few times. Mm. So, and I've been trying to pick up Spanish, you know, spent $500 on the Rosetta Stone. That's trying.
Anyway. It is trying, and it's actually, Rosetta Stone is really good. I'm a big
Rosetta
fan.
Rosetta Stone is good.
I think it's hard. Have you started to do the thing where you talk to people?
No.
That's fucked up.
No.
Because then they schedule...
Only the images.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then you get to the point when then they schedule those appointments where you do these conversations with other students, and then they oversee... The software oversees it.
Wow.
So that's really hard because that's what you learn. Because then when you're stuck in the conversation, and then... But at least with Korean, the alphabet is the tough thing for me. At least, you know, like Spanish uses the same alphabet. There's different little symbols and stuff, but it's the same alphabet. So you have a little bit of a head start. But it's hard. I think it's a good thing.
So you're on that level with Korean, mm-hmm. and the Rosetta Stone.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
When you talk to people now, I get real nervous. I also watch Korean. I can watch Korean movies without subtitles, and I can explain to people what's happening.
Yeah. Did you ever see Old Boy?
Yeah.
That Korean classic?
I love that movie. It's a great movie.
I have it. I haven't watched it yet.
So it's one of the greatest... I think it is the greatest if you, if you're looking at the sort of the new Hallyu wave, it is the ultimate. And Choi Min-sik, the star, is one of the most charismatic stars ever. He's great, but it's a great movie. The American one, I think, is pretty good too.
I bought the bootleg of the original Old Boy. I haven't watched it. What are other like highlights of Korean cinema?
The Host. The Old Boy is actually three movies. There's one. It's the first one is Old Boy. The second is I think it's Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance, and the third one is Lady Vengeance. And they're the best. They're the ultimate. They're like the Godfathers of Korea because they're three intense like revenge crime thrillers. But I love all kinds of Korean movies, and I like the dramas, and you know, they just have a very good way of storytelling. It's a tough business there, so it's just beautiful. They really pour everything into it. They think really strangely sometimes, and
I love Korea. I can't wait for you. I want you to go there, film a documentary. Hour special, turn it into a stand-up hour.
Mm-hmm.
When was the last time you were there?
I literally have not been there since I was 13.
Yeah, your brain is going to explode with friggin' ideas. And
I think so.
And this enlightenment renaissance that Korea is having now with like kind of conquering the world through pop culture.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're doing it.
Yeah.
It's that whole soft power. Mm-hmm. Thing and with music and art and you know that you're talking about the Joan Rivers thing before. It's funny, like Korean people really don't like and don't understand why people make fun of them for eating dogs.
No, they
don't
get it.
That's like something people in Korea like. Why do the people think that's funny?
Yeah,
I've talked to Korean people there, and they're like,
yeah. They don't get.
They don't get like why the people make that joke.
I think it's funny when my dad comes over to my house. He starts massaging my dog's ass, like to soften it up because he's going to eat her. He keeps talking about how this is the kind of dog that I like to eat, delicious. And then he starts tenderizing her meat. And I'm like, I'm going to kill you. But it's really funny. They don't understand why it's funny. It's funny.
Yeah.
It's really good.
When do you think, are you got any plans? Or you got to like, you think 5 years from now you could master Korean enough to do this?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, I think if I go there too, it would speed it up. Because when you go there and you're immersed in language, it just becomes part of you. And then you just get it. I think I should probably do that instead and then just be there for a while. I think it would help me too, but it would be fun.
Yeah, it's really exciting there.
Yeah.
I mean, and they're people are so fashionable and...
Yeah, really fashionable and really cool. And I have some friends out there. I'm friends with this band called Galaxy Express, and they are... Korea's Nirvana. they're like huge, but they're so like rock and roll and like hardcore. And so if I went there, I could hang out with like rock stars and stuff, which would be really fun. Mm-hmm. So someday.
Well, and I was telling you last night about this book that I'm reading right now. It's called Super Sad True Love Story.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of set in the future. And this guy's in Rome. He's a New York guy that, and he falls in love with this Korean American girl, and then they go back to New York. I'm only about, you know, halfway through the book, but it's kind of set in the future, and it's kind of funny. Her immigrant parents from Korea had come, and the father's like a podiatrist or something.
Mm-hmm.
But now in this book, Korea is booming economically. Mm-hmm. And Korean immigrants to America are like kind of sad that they left. They're like they missed the boat. Like,
yeah.
They came to America for this new better life, and now Korea is just like on top of the world and a huge economic engine.
Yeah. But it's tough there too. It's tough. Like if you there's a major problem there with suicide. There's a major problem there with depression. There's a rumor about you doing drugs, they'll cut your hair and test your hair. And if your hair has evidence of drugs, like anything like pot, they'll put you in prison for 2 years. It's like so restrictive. Some things haven't gotten better. Some things haven't caught up with the rest of the world. So it's a very weird, it's a weird place. There's a lot of stuff that culturally is a little bit strange to deal with too.
What about Kim Il-un in North Korea? Like, that's such a fascinating world to me. Like, Kim Jong-un,
Kim Jong-il loved cinema
so much. Mm-hmm. It was reputed that he had every film that had ever won Best Picture.
Mm-hmm.
And he loved cinema so much, he kidnapped this South Korean filmmaker and his actress wife and forced them to make a movie in North Korea.
Yeah.
That's just fascinating.
Yeah. My Korean name is North Korea, and it's Moran, and that's the name of Kim Jong-il's film production company. So
what's the name?
Moran.
What's it mean?
It's the peony flower. So the symbol is like a big peony, and that's my Korean first name. So my family is also, part of my family is from North Korea too. So it's the traditional to name me that, but it's also his production company name. I don't know why it's such a weird thing. So, but yeah, it's true. They're so weird over there. I mean, that's another thing too. That's a really bizarre place. I'd love to go there, but I don't know if I can. I don't know who can.
Yeah. Well, apparently people go.
Dennis Rodman gets to. Vice gets to.
Yeah.
Vice gets to go over there, but I haven't been able to crack it yet.
Well, what is the greatest vacation you ever took in your life?
I love Italy. I just like to go to Italy and just eat. You know, like I'll go and I just get up some little place like kind of not far from the Colosseum, just like some trashy whatever bed and breakfast, just like hole up there, but then just go and eat everything. Like I love Roman food, I love like artichokes, and I love bucatini, like I love pasta and like wine, and I mean it's everything that I want. So I just like to just sit there and eat. It's beautiful. I like Florence too. I love all of it, but Venice is a little too crowded. I prefer...
Where do you like?
Florence.
Florence
is...
Yeah, the last 3 years in a row, my wife and I have gone to Rome.
Oh, Rome is so
and
beautiful.
And just, we were obsessed with Caravaggio, and then we like pretend like we live there. We'll rent an apartment somewhere for a couple weeks.
Yeah, it's so good.
It's great.
The food is just so good.
It's insanely good.
And people are beautiful. And it's just fun.
And I love that, you know, you told me the... what's the street in Paris that you like to shop on? Can we give that away?
Well, it's all like the Rue de Temple, or Rue, and it's all Le Marais. The whole neighborhood, Le Marais, is where all of these like really cool like boutiques are, and it's a very gay area. It's the original, I think, Jewish Orthodox area, and so there's still a lot of great like synagogues and kind of stuff like that, like really old buildings. And I mean, that's my favorite, but Le Marais is tremendous. It's where I always stay, and it's always packed with people, and everybody's beautiful. And you know, La Java, if you do La Java with Carol, it's not too far to walk. It's the gay neighborhood, and it's just fierce. You just feel so fierce in Paris all the time. I do. I just feel really special and great, and I love that we get to work there.
Yeah,
that's magic.
Well, I've got a long history with Paris because the first love of my adult life was from there.
Mm-hmm.
I got maced the first time I went to Paris.
Mm-hmm.
Her mother lived in the Bastille area by Père Lachaise, and then I've gone there and performed for years.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Where'd you get maced?
On the Rue de Lappe in the Bastille area. There's all these, it's a street with all these bars on it.
Mm-hmm.
And the first time I went to Paris, Natalie got sick one night, and I got to go out by myself, and I'm walking down the Rue de Lappe, and there's all these bars, and there's a bar called Some Girls. That's the name of a Rolling Stones album. They only play the Rolling Stones. I'm having a great night by myself. And then finally I leave this bar, and it's this thin Parisian street, and these two guys are coming towards me, and then they jumped me as they got close, and, you know, they don't have guns. I heard this was a common technique. They maced me.
Mm.
And then they try and beat you up and get you on the ground and take mm-hmm. whatever you have.
Mm-hmm.
But I got away, and it was excruciating pain.
Yeah.
Took me hours to get back to where I was staying, uh-huh. to Natalie's mom's house. Thank God it was raining.
Yeah.
I just had to keep stopping, and I'd sit in doorways for like, 20 minutes, half hour, just in excruciating
God,
pain.
That's terrible.
And then like walk and hold my eyes open and let the raindrops hit me.
Yeah.
It was terrible.
That's really terrible.
But the fact that I was maced in the city of love, I think there's something romantic about that.
Yeah. That makes sense. You know, like where... What time is it? We gotta go.
We gotta go.
Oh shit, we have to get a Uber.
Any other worldwide great travel tips or?
I think
because I'm gonna go back to Paris in a few weeks now.
Yeah,
just seeing you reminds me I need to.
You gotta go to Paris. I think that like you just have to be aware of what you're doing. No place in the world is really unsafe, you know, if you know how to be there. You just have to be aware of what's going on, and if something happens, don't let it ruin your feelings of that place.
Of that place, right. Because so many people don't like Paris. And I always say, where did you stay?
Mm-hmm.
No, I stayed by the Arc de Triomphe. Yeah, around the touristy areas, the people are going to be dicks in hotels because they only deal with tourists. And then I've talked to people who, you know, went to Amsterdam and stayed in the red light district. You don't stay in a hotel in the red light district.
No. It's not. Yeah. You got to get out and see the city and walk around and get a baguette and, you know, just live it. It's the best. I mean, I think it's just magical and beautiful. And, you just feel so special there. I like it all.
Do you have any questions for me?
Well, where do you think you'll go next now? What's happening from, like, how many times do you go all over? And do you have a place that you guys live? Is there, like, a city that you live in?
We don't live anywhere. I've had everything in storage for 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll do, I spend about 4 months a year in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
We'll do, like, 2 months at a time in Europe. Last year we did a month in New Zealand. Do a month in Asia. There's great gigs all over Asia. I'll do a month in Australia. And then there's just constant gigs all over the States.
Mm-hmm.
So when we have time off, the last 3 years in a row, we've gone to Rome and rented an apartment.
Yeah.
Sleepinitaly.com
mm-hmm.
is a great place to find apartments. I'm gonna go back in October. Well, maybe I'll try Florence this time.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
But, I think we might end up getting a place back in Amsterdam.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure, but we're just enjoying the jet set lifestyle. And I love it because we're not paying rent.
Yeah.
You know, everything I only own 7 things, but all those 7 things are of absolute top quality.
Right,
know, the best clothes and shoes and luggage. And what more do you need to travel the world as a comedian?
What kind of bag do you think I should get? Because my
You need a better piece of luggage.
I know it's terrible.
And someone of your stature, you can't be walking around with some discount luggage.
It's like totally from Target.
For me, I'm like...
No,
I had to take your luggage from yesterday because I didn't want anybody to see you pull it.
No, it's terrible. But it's like, how do you... What do you get? Like, what is... I don't even know, like, what nice is. I usually just wear and... You know, everything I have is stuff I got for free. So
you're very fashionable.
I am very fashionable.
You always have beautiful clothes on and stuff. But you need to. I like Travel Pro. This garment bag that folds and opens because like things you can the things won't be as wrinkly.
Right.
You can arrive to a city, open your bag, and pull it out, and it's like kind of halfway preserved anyway.
Yeah.
Tumi makes great luggage. And then that Swiss brand that your luggage is an imitation of.
Yeah, yeah.
They make really quality stuff too. I like that kind of garment bag that unzips and then you fold it over and then you pull it.
That's best. I think, I think I need to actually go get one. I want to get one of those like leather suitcases that's like kind of like, it's got the buckles on the outside.
Right.
Those like really, really expensive ones. You just buy one for your whole life.
Right, right.
So I need to invest, but I never, ever have. And I've always had terrible luggage. But you ever see comics like come to the club with like a garbage bag?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I remember Greg Rogel coming to the Punchline and he had a garbage bag.
That's so funny that you mentioned that because Greg Rogel stayed with me in San Francisco in the 90s and he showed up. It was a paper bag, like a lunch bag, like the kind you would carry your lunch in, a tiny paper bag. And he had his toothbrush and one t-shirt and one pair of underwear. And I thought, wow, that is like the best way to travel.
That is. It's so great. He was so funny. It was good.
Margaret, I adore you.
I love you.
I absolutely cherish your friendship and the inspiration you've gave me through the years. Like, you weathering certain storms in your life and turning it into art, you know? I mean, a lot of people have not survived in this business. Mm-hmm. And the fact that, you know, you and I are still slugging it out. I think you are Joan of Arc, Samurai Warrior.
Oh my God, well thank you.
Yeah.
So are you, well thank you.
In closing, is there any words of wisdom or advice that you'd like to give to the people of the earth?
I think, just keep going. I think just don't give up. It's really hard, but it's supposed to be hard. And if it's hard, it's actually better for you. So everything that I've been through that's been painful, I've actually come out better for it. So the pain should be embraced, as difficult as that is. That's the best thing you can do.
Amen, sister.
Yeah.
Margaret, long may you run, sister.
Thank you.
Long may you run.